I stood at the sink in an impossibly bright hospital room, washing my face, washing away the heat that, with the doctor's words, had come rushing to my face and neck and chest to fill every pore, to gather in the corners of my eyes and to line my lips and thicken my tongue. "He will never walk. His brain is dead," the doctor had said. It still burned. How much cold water would it take to take the hot sting out of those words? My father lay immobile behind me, a crisp sheet folded neatly across his chest, the crease apparently to be forever perfect above his forever still form. I had not been able to bear to see him like that any longer, so I turned away and instead watched my own warped reflection in the metal mirror that seemed to mimic the distortions within me. The doctor's words were all I could hear inside my head, but they were too immense, too life-changing to stay in my head. They spilled out and filled the room, bouncing back from the walls and the metal me in the mirror, and with every echo a new torment. "He will not walk. His brain is dead. He will not walk. His brain is dead." I kept cupping water to my face, unable to cool the heat, but equally unable to stop trying. The day before, this solid man who would be 70 in 4 days, who still had cannonballs for shoulders and the calf muscles of a 25-year-old fullback, had fallen over while eating a salad for dinner. He had played tennis in the morning and had gone biking in the afternoon. He came in to dinner after planting spring flowers in the yard. Every minute of his day was a test of his body, a test he passed over and over again. And then, with no warning, a massive stroke, and he could not move from the floor. I was 40 years old, and I had never seen him fail at a single physical thing he had tried to do, not once in 40 years. I closed my eyes as I cupped the water, and the images of my well father, strong and full of life, gathered on top of one another. Eating a hot pepper from his garden in Naples and thinking it a green pepper, his face goes flush, tears fill his eyes, his glasses fog up, but he chews on. And then, grinning at his astonished family, he gets up and picks another. The awestruck faces of the enlisted men he commanded in Japan when he came out of the pool into which they had thrown him, and with his soaking wet flight suit clinging to him, they saw his supremely muscled form outlined. News that he had made captain had come in while he was on an early morning flight, so when he stepped out of the jet in his flight suit, his squadron had rallied around him, cheering, and had thrown him into the pool in giddy celebration. I always suspected that the vision of him earned him a respect from those enlisted men that morning that the additional stripe on his sleeve would not have won him. I had sat with him at Bethesda Naval Hospital when he had 4 discs in his spine fused, the final remedy 2 decades after his back was injured, when the wheels on the jet he was getting ready to pilot collapsed beneath the plane on the tarmac. He should have been groggy and still in the hours after recovery, but he was smiling at everyone and teasing the nurses by pretending to smoke an endless series of imaginary cigarettes. Within weeks, he was back on his bicycle, and within months, he was back on the tennis court. There was the time his nose was flattened in college in a football game. The doctor said it was so crushed that he could choose whatever shape he wanted, since they were starting from scratch. So he chose the shape he had had before, and he took up lacrosse, and he was an All-American his first year. He used to lift women up, my mother and her friends, and twirl them head over heels like batons. Proper women in 1950s shirtwaists ignored the fact that their garter belts had been on display, and they giggled to be treated as girls again. He carried my brother, my sister, and me all at once on his wide shoulders upstairs to bed when we were youngsters, as if we were stuffed animals. Now, impossibly, he lay dying behind me, unable to move, unable to speak. The doctor had called us into the room to tell us. My sister sat with her arm around my mother. My brother sat holding our father's hand. I stood at the foot of the bed, my eyes on my father's still face, not on the doctor I'd never seen before. Each of us cried, not in a wailing way, but in low, lonely moans. The doctor talked on about the effect of the stroke on the blood flow to his brain, and we each half listened, for truthfully, nothing after "his brain is dead" could penetrate. Tracks of silent tears covered all of our cheeks. When the doctor left, we all hugged one another, grieving our collective loss and our individual ones. Then everyone else left the room. I had to tell my children, 10-year-old Wade and 8-year-old Kate, where they waited in the hall with their father, and I had to wash my face before I would tell them. I could clean the tear tracks, but the heat would not go away. I gave up and turned to leave and face the children. As I turned, I looked again at my father, but now he was looking back. He was still immobile, his huge bulk still pinned beneath the tight sheets, but his eyes were open. Not just open, but wide dishes of panic. He could not speak, and yet he did. We stood staring at one another, I haven't any idea how long, and he said, or his eyes said, "I am here. I am not dead. I am here. I want to live." I answered back in words. "Don't worry," I said. "We know. We're not giving up on you." And I marched past my family to the nurse's station and told them that that doctor was not allowed back into my father's room under any circumstances.